Class is back in session. It's time for Baptist Basics University from BaptistBasics.org. Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. I am Matthew Gage, and today we will be continuing our series on the Book of Daniel. This will be lesson number 7 in the series as we look at chapter number 6. Very famous, and if you have been in Sunday school since a little kid, I'm sure you know the story, Daniel in the Lion's Den. Now, with this chapter, we will close out the historical portion of the Book of Daniel. And as we've mentioned before, chapters 7 through 12 are more prophetic in nature and contain various prophecies and such. But this closes out the first half of the book, and where the main focus really is on the history and story of Daniel and his friends. Now, chapter 6 of Daniel, it takes place very late in the life of Daniel. Daniel is a very elderly man at this time, probably in his 80s. Babylon has been conquered, as we saw in the previous chapter. And the new power in town is the Persian Empire, or the Medo-Persian Empire, well, because of the alliance of the Medes and the Persians. And they're in charge now. They are ruling most of the then known world, I guess you could say. And Daniel has retained power and influence from the Babylonian Empire into the Persian Empire, and still is a greatly respected advisor and administrator. And this, of course, does not sit well with some of the up-and-comers who want to get rid of Daniel. And the story of chapter 6 is a plot against Daniel to remove him from power, to discredit him, to do away with him. And not even maybe against Daniel, but also against King Darius also. This may have been something of a way to undermine his authority also, possibly. So, before we begin, we've already seen in chapter 5, of course, that Babylon has fallen and that the Persians have come in. In verse 31 of chapter 5, it talks about Darius the Mede taking over the kingdom. And I believe I promised you that we would talk a little bit about Darius. So we'll do that, and we'll talk a little bit about the Persian Empire. Just to set up the chapter, let's go ahead and do this as a way of introduction. The Persian Empire, or what is historically speaking this particular dynasty or form of the Persian Empire, I believe you pronounce this Achaemenid. I hope I'm close on that. The Achaemenid Empire, Achaemenid. And this particular form of the Persian Empire lasted from 550 to 330 BC. Now, the reason why I say this particular form, like so many times, even when we talk about Babylonian history, you know, there were different times where Babylon would be a power, then it'd be conquered and be a power again. Egypt's the same way. Even, you know, Greece in some senses is also that way. Well, this area, these peoples have had some power before and will even regain some more power, even at the time of the Roman Empire, as the Parthian Empire will kind of be in the same region. So, but this particular form of the Persian, of this empire, is called the Achaemenid Empire. It lasts from about 550 to 330 BC. This is the second great empire that was prophesied by Daniel back in chapter 2. Remember, with the statue, the head of gold, and the chest of silver, and the arms of silver. That silver second section is the symbol of this empire, the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire came in and conquered the Babylonians, and will last until they are conquered by the Greeks underneath Alexander the Great. Originally, the territory for Persia is for this empire is in modern-day Iran. So when we say Babylon, we in modern day terms think Iraq. When we say Persia, think modern day Iran, and that'll give you a good sense of the territories. They had a couple different capitals, Persepolis, Pisagarde. And then even later on, they had Susa, which was like a summer home kind of thing too. But anyway, so they had different capitals at different times. The nucleus and I guess the beginning of this empire is an alliance between different tribes. There's many different tribal people, races in this area. And two of the main ones form an alliance, the Medes and the Persians. At the time when this is formed, it seems like the Medes probably were more powerful, but the Persians end up kind of drowning them out and taking over. This coalition of the Medes and Persians gains power, gains territory, and then finally we kind of recognize it as an empire, as a world power underneath the leader Cyrus the Great, who ruled from 559 to 530 BC. He's mentioned a few times in the Bible. In 540 BC, under Cyrus the Great and his generals, they conquer Babylon. And then, like I mentioned before, they last up until 330 BC, where they're conquered by Alexander the Great. The Persian Empire is the major power at the end of the Old Testament. The Old Testament closes out about 400 BC, so this still falls within the time period where Persia is still the dominant power. And different prophets that wrote during this time, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, and of course Daniel, all of their stories and prophecies take place during this time frame of the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire also is important when they come in and conquer Babylon. They allow the Israelites to go back and resettle their land, rebuild the temple, rebuild Jerusalem. So that's a very important part for the history of Israel, is Persia's allowance of them to go back to their land and rebuild and reestablish their identity. Now, that'll give you an idea of who the Persians are. Let's look at Darius the Mede. We've already read Daniel chapter 5 and verse 31. Darius the Mede took the kingdom being about 62 years old. So about 62 years old if you're keeping score. Who is this guy? Well, according to Daniel, we can get a little bit about him. We see here in, as I just read in chapter 5, verse 31, that we can see his name is Darius. Okay. We can see he was a Mede by race. He was of that tribe, that he took over Babylon, and that at the time of doing that, he was about 62 years old, which in ancient times, that's a ripe old age. Even in the Roman Empire, the average age, I believe, was calculated to only be up into maybe around 40 on average, if I remember correctly. I mean, it's nowhere near the 70 plus that it is today, thanks to modern medicine and such. And plus, you got to think with different wars and diseases and things like that. The life expectancy was not even close to what it is today. So someone who's 62 years old is going to be looked upon as probably is revered. And I believe I've talked about this before when talking about Daniel being kind of an elder statesman. But this 62-year-old guy is going to be seen as someone old, wise, seasoned, and going to be very well respected for that. Now, we also see in chapter 9, he's mentioned, in chapter 9, verse 1. I'll flip over there real quick. And it says, the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus. So now we see that Darius the Mede, his father's name is Ahasuerus, which we don't really know who that is either, of the seed of the Mede. So we've already seen that he's a Mede by his tribe, by his race. And it says, which was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans. So once again, we have the little detail that he ruled over Babylon, the Chaldean people. So it's kind of talking about the area, the people there around Babylon. So there's a little bit of confusion about Darius. And I'll be honest, most of the time when I read about errors in the Bible and historical errors and different things like that, honestly, I find that the people pointing them out have no idea what they're talking about. I question whether they've even read the passages that they claim to have found these errors in. As I'm recording this, it's a few days after Christmas, and I happen to see some stuff online even this year about, you know, well, if the wise men had done this, there's no possible way, you know. And it talked about, okay, this is what the article said. They followed, the wise men followed the star from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. They didn't follow the star from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. They saw a star and went to Jerusalem seeking the king. It doesn't, I don't even necessarily know that you could say that they even were looking up and the star was guiding them. I think they saw a star and knew where to go based on Bible prophecy. But anyway, they show up in Jerusalem and King Herod's men tell them, hey, go down to Bethlehem. So they didn't even follow the star. There's not a verse in there where it talks about the wise men following a star from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. But there was this huge article making the rounds about how it's impossible. The Bible is so wrong because those wise men could have never found Bethlehem by following the star. And it was stupid if they even did because Bethlehem's right there close. All they had to do is get on the road and go. Well, yeah, it's all stupid, but that's, you know, what they were saying, because it didn't happen that way. You know, they got there, Herod's men said, oh, hey, you probably ought to go look in Bethlehem and take that road down there, you know, second right at the left, you know, and gave them directions to go. So, honestly, this article making the rounds, trying to, you know, poke holes in the Bible narrative, wasn't even talking about what the Bible says. And a lot of the stuff like that, when people start poking and attacking the Bible so many times, I wonder where in the world they got the information, because my Bible doesn't tell that version of the story that they say. So in this case, this is another one with Darius the Mede. Darius the Mede, we don't know a lot about him. In fact, we know next to nothing about him except for what I just told you from Daniel chapter 5 and Daniel chapter 9. So what are the modern theories? Well, the critics of the Bible mainly will say he didn't even exist. That, of course, whoever wrote the book of Daniel, you know, of course, the book of Daniel, in their opinion, isn't even real. It isn't authentic. But whoever wrote the book of Daniel just made this guy up. And here's proof that, you know, you can't trust the Bible, that you can't trust whoever wrote Daniel, because they just made up this guy out of thin air. Well, that's one theory. Another theory is that Darius, it just happens to be another name for Cyrus the Great. There's not too much evidence for that I can tell, but that's a theory. And you deal with that sometimes in the Bible, where you will have an individual named, and the name that's given in the Bible is maybe the Hebrew form of the name, or maybe even a name that's not been passed down, and historically we know these people by. Just like, for instance, historically speaking, you had Emperor Gaius over the Roman Empire. Well, nobody knows him as that, because everyone knows him as Caligula. And Caligula, if you go back and look at his coins, he's never called Caligula. That was just kind of his little, you know, nickname from a kid that they kind of whispered behind his back. But he was not known as Caligula, at least officially. That was long after his death that, you know, the writers and people just simplified things and called him Caligula, and he became known as that. So, you know, that's just one example. So, possibly Darius could be a name. Maybe Darius is, Cyrus's, you know, first name. Maybe it's his, name in the Mede language and not the Persian language, or, you know, maybe something like that. But even that, there's not a whole lot of evidence for it. Now, there is historically an individual, a general named Gubaru. in the like Persian records. And a lot of people say, well, Darius must be this Gubaru guy, because it kind of would make sense. He seems to have been the one to conquer Babylon, actually to have led the troops. So perhaps Darius is just another name for Gubaru. And okay, that could be. Like I said, using the, you know, different names, different languages kind of thing I just told you about, that could make sense. Another little detail, I think this is from Jewish traditions, is that he actually is an uncle of Cyrus, and that's how he gets into power and gets his position. Now, historically speaking, I don't think that there's much evidence for that. That's just kind of like the Jewish traditions is where that comes from. Now, after doing a little bit of study, I'm going to give you my theory. It's kind of a half-baked theory. I'm not going to write a thesis paper or anything on this anytime soon. But looking at this, let me give you my opinion on who I think Darius the Mede possibly could be. I think Darius the Mede is not the national major ruler, the emperor, the king, whatever, of Persia. I think probably this guy is a provincial ruler. In the United States, we'd say he's not, you know, he wouldn't be the president, but he would be a governor, you know, over a state or over a territory, something like that. So I think very likely he's not the major ruler. We know that Cyrus the Great historically. And nowhere in here, by the way, in the Bible, there's little clues here. The Bible doesn't say he is the ruler of Persia. It just says he rules over Babylon. In chapter 5, verse 31, it talks about him taking the kingdom. Well, what kingdom is that? That's the kingdom of Babylon, the region of Babylon, you know, that he takes control of. It doesn't say he took the Persian Empire. It basically says he took over the Babylonian Empire, took over that region. It appears in chapter 6, verse 1, talks about, we'll get into some of this, he's setting up a government structure with different rulers. Now, that could be on a national scale, yes, but I think Darius the Mede was given control to administrate over Babylon and to help convert it over to the Persian way of life, the Persian way of governing, and just to see over that transition period. And now this would make some sense for, that we wouldn't know a lot about this guy. Provincial rulers aren't that well known in history. Here in America, if you're an American, listening to this, I know I've got some correspondence from people that are not, so I know I can have maybe a little bit of an international audience. So that's why I keep saying, you know, here in America and stuff like that, trying to be respectful, and I don't want to assume people are following along with me. But here in America, we can name a lot of presidents. It's very easy. Why? Because, you know, there's only been 40 something of them. George Washington, John Adams, John Quincy Adams, Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, Andrew Johnson, Woodrow Wilson, Teddy Roosevelt, FDR. We could just go on and on and on and rattle off. We may not get all 40 of them, but I bet you if you sit down, you can think of a lot of presidents. It's not that hard. Okay, the challenge I would have for you now is to sit down and whatever state you live in, write down as many governors as you did presidents. And I can almost guarantee you can't do it. The governors just disappear. Now, here in Texas, I can name a few. Sam Houston was one, and Richardson was one, George W. Bush was one, Rick Perry is it now. I might get lucky and name maybe up to about 10. At the same time, I guarantee you I can get close. I can probably get more than 30 presidents, if not almost all of them. I'm pretty confident I'd get at least 30. So, I even know Millard Fillmore and Franklin Pierce. So, that's going to make sure that I get up there and get quite a few. But you know, so provincial rulers just kind of get lost in the mix. They get lost in history. I mean, we remember the Caesars, but the proconsuls who would be sent to a territory to govern it, you know, we don't usually remember them. And, you know, historically, there may be mentions of them in historical accounts, but there's plenty of those type of guys who just history has forgotten. And I think Darius the Mede probably is this, you know, territorial governor who is just forgotten to history, so to speak, outside of the scriptures here. And going along with this theory, I think Darius the Mede, he's an older guy, 62, and probably, you know, that's when he takes over. And I've got a feeling, based on some of the accounts and stuff, a little bit that I've read, I don't think that he lived very much longer, and that after his death, he was still over Babylon, and that Cyrus just took it over from him. In fact, I believe there actually is a scripture. Oh, wow. I don't remember which. Let me see if I can. I thought it was Daniel chapter 10 or 11, but I don't believe it is. Okay, never. But I want to say that there is a record where it talks about Cyrus taking over from Darius, and that isn't. I don't think that Cyrus succeeded Darius. It's just that after Darius died, that territorial government went away and was absorbed by the imperial government of the Persian Empire. So, you know, this would be like Rick Perry here in Texas, our governor, has a heart attack and dies. And, you know, instead of Texas getting another governor, the federal government in Washington, D.C. just says, okay, you know what, we're just going to take over direct control. And as far as we're concerned, you know, the new governor, quote unquote, of the state of Texas is the president of the United States. So that gives you an idea, I think, of what went on. That couldn't happen under our constitutional system, but you're not talking about constitutional systems back then. You know, you're talking about a guy with a whole lot of power, in like an emperor type role, and basically just doing whatever he pleases. And if he decided, hey, I want to take over that, you know, area, he would have been able to just to take over that area. So anyway, that's my theory. Wow, I've rambled 20 minutes and we haven't even read a verse of scripture. Which I don't think they'll hurt us too bad. Really, it's a pretty short passage here that we're going to look at and look through. And plus it's so familiar to many people. I don't feel like I have to take a lot of time to explain. So let's look here to make sure I've got everything. We covered Persian Empire, covered Darius the Mede. In the notes, when I get those out and available, which they'll be available, of course, on the website. I won't put them into the podcast feed until we're done. But I actually have a map. I didn't color in everything quite right on it, but I have a map that I kind of traced off another one, just to give you an idea of the extent and size of the Persian Empire. It's much, much larger than the Babylonian Empire, stretching from Greece and Egypt all the way over into India. Okay, well, let's get started here. Daniel chapter 6 and verse number 1. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom. Verse 2, and over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was the first, and the princes, that the princes might give accounts unto them, and the king have no damage. So, first thing, it seems like that Darius comes in to this situation. You know, he's with the Persian Empire. He's a Mede. He's with the Persians. They've taken over and conquered Babylon. He's in charge. I assume, I kind of believe he's in charge of, you know, making sure this transition period goes well. Probably, you know, when you think about that too, I mean, they just conquered these people. They've been bitter enemies. They've been fighting. There's a lot at stake that he's having to go through just to make sure they don't try to rebel again, that there's not another flare up there, to basically have a peaceable transition, to what, you know, what's left of Babylon Empire into becoming just another territory of the Persian Empire. So in doing that, he's taken the kingdom and put 120 different princes, as the Bible calls them here, but 120 different, you know, like local rulers over different areas to watch over and make, you know, to give some bureaucracy to the government and to watch over things and to help govern the area. And then over these 120 princes, there are what the Bible calls presidents. And those 120 princes answer to and report to these three presidents. The main one, the one with the most seniority, the most power, is Daniel, you know, our very elderly hero at this point, is the number one president. Now, is he the king? No, he's not. You know, Darius is still the head man. But basically what this says is the number two guy in the kingdom in Babylon is Daniel. So verse 3. Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. So we see Daniel's status here, that Daniel, once again, like in every situation we find him in, he's excelling. And you know, it amazes me. Some people, doesn't matter what you put them into, they excel. You know, God blesses them, or even just their attitudes and their work ethic just makes them excel. You know, I've thought it would be an interesting experiment to take individuals, entrepreneurs, you know, successful in like a business type setting, you know, millionaires who have started companies and done things. I've always thought it'd be an interesting experiment just to take one of those people or a bunch of them and go basically just drop them off in a town they don't have connections to, don't have contacts in, and give them, you know, $1,000, and then basically go back in a month and see what they've been able to accomplish. And you know, those type of people who are successful, you know, it's not the job that makes people successful. It's the person is a success. And so I imagine, you know, they may not be a millionaire in a month, but I'd almost guarantee you they would be in some type of management deal. Wherever they're working, whether they've been able to start their own company or get in to another company, they're going to have increased sales. You know, they're going to be successful in what they do. Why? Because, you know, that's who they are. They have the work ethic. They have the knowledge. They know they have the skills. They know the tricks of the trade. And so I think if you were to take, you know, a highly successful business person, drop them off in the middle of nowhere, somewhere they've never been, I think they could still make a success out of their life because they've got those skills. And with Daniel, you know, we see him in all the different situations that the God has him in. You know, he still excels above everyone else. He still rises to the top, no matter when or where or who he's compared to. Verse 4. Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find none occasion nor fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. So the up-and-comers, the people who would just pull you off the ladder of success and stomp on you and stab you in the back, you know, to get up a little bit higher on the food chain, these people immediately mark Daniel, say, we're getting rid of him. You know, he's an old man, whatever, you know, if we get rid of Daniel, then we can move up and, you know, have a chance at being, the new number one guy in the kingdom. Or even, there is even a little bit of evidence we'll get into that I think maybe that this plot is deeper than just against Daniel. This may be something to undermine Darius. And, you know, that possibly by taking away his number one advisor, someone who is very effective, they undermine his authority. They can make him look bad if he's tricked into doing this. But some of this may be to get at not just Daniel, but also to Darius. I like here also that when they go after Daniel and decide, you know, hey, we're going after him, let's dig up all the dirt on him we have, let's do some research, you know, we're going to find whatever he did, and we're going to plaster it all over the front pages of the paper, we're going to smear his name, drag him through the mud, we're going to go out and ruin this man. When they went out and they did their research and they studied Daniel and they studied his career, they could find absolutely nothing. The man was spotless. And boy, that is a challenge to me. You know, when somebody looks at my life, you know, could they find something that they could point their finger at me and say, well, looky there, buddy, you really messed up. Now, that's what Satan does. Satan looks at our lives and say, look, you messed up. Oh, you think you're a child of God? Well, wow, look, you sinned right there. You know, those accusations come. Now, we can't be perfect, you know, or completely sinless, you know, while living here on earth, you know, battling the flesh, battling the world, battling Satan. But, you know, having such great character and having such a great testimony, it's a lot of work. Just that level of consistency is tremendously hard. But Daniel lived that way. And, you know, I know even people today, they can have that type of reputation where if you hear something about them, you just don't believe it. Like, there's no way that person, you know, if I were to go up to you and think of a friend right now, and if I were to go up to you and say, hey, I heard so-and-so is actually a serial killer. Well, you know, depending on who your friend is, you might think, oh, that's possible. Depends on what kind of friend you have. Or you might think, well, there's no way that person's a serial killer. They're very moral. You know, they go to church. They, you know, they're nice. They're clean cut. They don't fit the description. You know, whatever the case may be. But, you know, but if I made that accusation, there's people you would believe it about, and there's people you absolutely wouldn't. Well, with Daniel, they could find nothing that they could attack him over. And with his reputation, with his testimony, they knew even if they made something up, it wouldn't stick because no one would believe him. So this puts them in quite the predicament. Verse 5, then said these men, we shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God. So they said, okay, if we're going to get Daniel, the only way we can get him is to attack his religion. Now, remember, Daniel is a Jew. Daniel is a practicing Jew. He has been faithful to the customs of his people, to his heritage, to that identity throughout the 80-something years of his life at this point. So they said, you know, if there's anything we can get him on, it's his religion. You know, it's not mainstream. He doesn't serve the gods of Babylon or Persia. So if there's one thing we can get him on, we're going to nail him on his religion. So they come up with the plot in verse 6. Then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king and said thus unto the king, King Darius, live forever. Yeah, you got to worry when people start buttering you up, you know. Verse 7, all the presidents of the kingdom, the governors, the princes, the counselors, and the captains. So basically what they're saying there, I don't want to get into, and well, this is this person, you know. Basically they're saying every ruler from the mayor on up to the, you know, the president, all agree in this. They said, have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of thee, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. So, verse 8, now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. So here's the plot. They go to the king and say, hey, king, we all got together, which they're lying. They left out at least one person. I don't think everybody was involved with this plot, but they did leave out one person because Daniel, as one of the presidents, was not there. They say, King, you know, we've got this great idea. We love you so much. We love the Persians coming in so much. Because the Persians, of course, every conqueror comes in, you know, we're delivering you. We're freeing you. You know, well, the Persians did that to you. We're freeing you from the evil Babylonian dictatorship or, you know, whatever. When basically, they're doing the same thing but as they come in. But anyway, they say, you know, we love you so much. We've got this way of honoring you that for 30 days, for a whole month, for a whole cycle of the moon, basically, as they probably would have measured it back then. They said, no one is allowed to pray or to a god or pray to any man to ask anything except they ask you. And, you know, and this is a great plan. You know, it'll give us a chance to show our love and respect for you and give you a chance to help the people and fulfill these needs. And people will look at you and say, wow, he heard, you know, he took care of my request. And I'm sure they just came up with all these great reasons. You know, the polls, his numbers would look better in the polls. He'd be more popular. The people would love him and throw parades for him. And, you know, he'd get invited to the baseball game or whatever, you know. But I'm sure they buttered it up and just made it sound like this is the greatest thing ever, that for 30 days no one can pray. Or, and basically when it says pray there, we're talking about just asking for something. So we can't ask a god for anything. We can't ask a man for anything. We can't make a petition to the government. We have to go to you, because you, King, you're the man. And then verse 8, it talks about, now, King, this is what we want to do, so this is all you have to do now. Just make it law. And according to the Medes and the Persians, the way that they did, part of the feature of their government, is their laws were unchangeable. When something was written into the law, you couldn't change it, you couldn't alter it, it was set, it was secure. This was something they did for the sake of, you know, stability of the government. And really, you know, it's not that bad of an idea. Basically, it just says, you know, if we make a law, we're going to uphold it, we're going to keep it. Now, with the, you know, modern day, we've realized that, like, in the American system of government, every now and then you need to go back and tweak a law. So we have in place, you know, ways to go back and change it. But basically, we treat the Constitution and the laws as fixed. You know, this is, you know, the word is law, and we follow those laws to the letter. You know, unless we decide to go back and add an amendment or pass another law or something along those lines. Well, they didn't have that type of system. They weren't quite that far advanced in their theory of government. But that was one of their features. They didn't rule by, you know, just whatever mood the king felt like. If the king felt like getting up and chopping people's heads off, you know, well, you know, he couldn't, you know, wasn't quite that level of like a dictatorship, you know, that, there was some form of stability in government there, almost, I guess, kind of like a precursor to a constitutional form, in that when they pass the law, it's just fixed, it's set, that's the way it is. Once that is signed into law, can't change it. So, verse 9, wherefore King Darius signed the writing and the decree. So Darius falls for the trap. And I've even heard people, you know, preachers even imagine, you know, like, and say, okay, well, hey, guys, you know, y'all think it's a good idea. I trust you. And, you know, he's wanting to get in good with these guys. So when they come up with this, you know, petition, he's probably like, okay, well, hey, if it'll make them happy, you know, I mean, you think, you know, he's just coming in, taking over what used to be an hostile territory. You have this sign maybe of goodwill. So you jump at it. But I've even heard people saying, you know, maybe he asked them, all the presidents, really, Daniel's behind this too? And, oh, yeah, sure, Daniel's behind it. You know, maybe that conversation took place, maybe not. But whatever reason, Darius falls for it, hook, line, and sinker, you know, and doesn't, you know, he saw the worm, he didn't see the hook, you know, to use fishing metaphor. So verse 10, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. So when Daniel finds out that basically the way he worships his God is outlawed, he quits. He moans and complains. He gets on the radio and cusses out the president. What does he do? He remains faithful. Now, God's law, at least to a Christian, is superior to everything. You know, that's our what governs the actions, the behavior of a Christian ought to be God's law. You know, what he's commanded us to do, the principles he's given us in the Bible. Now, God has also set up human government and has blessed human government and uses human government, endorses human government. We could go to Romans chapter 13. God likes human government. And most of the time, the two are not in opposition. You can worship God and do just about anything you want to do in a lot of the world today. You may not be able to publicly have a church, but you can still pray. You can still have a Bible. You know, we're spoiled places like here in America. We can do whatever we want, basically, when it comes to religion. You know, other places don't quite have that level of freedom. And there are still places on this earth, you know, if you just don't worship in the right church or worship the right God, you're, you know, liable to get your head chopped off. There are still places like that. But, there is a lot of freedom in the world today where, you know, you may not be able to own a church building, but you probably could still kind of secretly get together. Even China, Russia, places like that, you know, in recent history that have really persecuted Christians and tried to outlaw Christianity, you know, they still had churches and Christianity still grew. So what I'm trying to say is God's law and human law usually complement each other. And God says to obey human law and human government. But every now and then they disagree with each other. So which one do you obey? Do you obey human law or do you obey God's law? Well, the answer for a Christian ought to be that we obey God's law. And now some of that we have to, and this is very interesting, and I've given some thought to this a little bit. And, so what do you do, say, if a government, if the United States of America suddenly outlawed churches? Said, you know, hey, you cannot, you know, have an organization called the church. You know, you cannot own property. You cannot, you know, have an auditorium and meet. Okay, does that mean you can't get together with believers? No, it doesn't. You know, does that mean you can't still, you know, try to follow God's law in your life? No, it doesn't. It just means you can't have a big church building and you can't, you know, do some of the stuff we're used to doing. You know, in times past, religious groups would, were outlawed and they were not able to own buildings or property. And they would just, you know, meet in the forest at night or meet in homes secretly or barns. But, you know, those people tried to, you know, respect the law, but, you know, they didn't just flaunt it and go out there and say, well, we're doing our thing. You know, they tried to respect the law. But when it contradicted God's law, they said, we're sorry, but we have to follow God's law. So, in the life of a Christian, God's law supports human law. But when they disagree, God's law is what a Christian ought to follow. If it came down, say, you know, they say the United States government says, well, Christians, it's, you know, you can be a Christian, but you cannot share your faith. It's illegal to go out and evangelize or proselytize or whatever you want to call it. You know, you can't go out and publicly share your faith. Well, now as a Christian, there is a commandment to share our faith, to go out and win the lost, to reach the world. Now, what that would mean is, you know, what do we do? Do we just hole up and hide and act like we're not Christians? No. That just means you probably can't go door to door. You couldn't have, you know, a big open air meeting. But does that mean you couldn't share your faith with a friend? No, it doesn't mean that at all. So, you know, we kind of have to adapt how we work things sometimes to be in compliance or sometimes just to kind of get around human law. But for the most part, at least here in America, this is so not an issue. There's hardly a question about this, and so many people get all flustered and rant and rave about, you know, churches are being attacked and losing their liberty, and churches are losing a lot of liberties that they historically have. But I really have yet to see anything come down where I felt like the very nature and core of Christianity was being directly attacked and being outlawed. Now, the church may not be able to operate the same way as it has in the past, maybe just, for IRS reasons or something, but, it doesn't mean a church can't exist. They just may need to reorganize into a different, form, maybe, give up nonprofit status and be reorganized in some other thing in the IRS handbook, something along those lines. In fact, it's funny. I'm really ranting on this, but a lot of churches, at least of my stripe today, they complain and say, well, we can't, talk about, you're not supposed to talk about politics in the pulpit. They'll come down and the IRS will come after you. Well, basically the IRS has organized and said, okay, if a church wants to be a nonprofit, they just need to stick to religious matters and they don't need to be a political organization. They don't need to be endorsing candidates and stuff like that. So basically, a church, if they want the nonprofit status and the benefits of that, contributions, tithes, and offerings being tax deductible, if they want that aspect of it, they choose to comply with the IRS, 50C3 or whatever it is, rules and regulations. A church can get political. A church can, talk politics and what have you, all the stuff that preachers say they can't, if they would give up and just forfeit their forfeit that nonprofit status and reorganize like as an incorporation or something like that. And it's a messy deal. It's not a good situation. That there really needs to be a lot of reform done in that area and tax code in general, in my opinion. But that's one case where, you hear preachers gripe and say, well, God's law says I ought to be able to do this, but human law doesn't. Well, actually, there are ways to do it even under human law. You just, need to go about it a different way. So anyway, boy, sorry, ran it a little bit too much there. But anyway, Daniel, he goes in, he prays as he normally does. The windows being open, chamber toward Jerusalem, that's him maintaining his identity. He's looking towards Jerusalem, his homeland, looking back off towards the west from where he's at, remembering that promised land, where the temple was, and praying in that direction. He doesn't even hide it. His windows are open. He's not even hiding what he's doing. It says he prayed three times a day. This is one of the few references to the three times a day. A lot of people say, well, how many times are you supposed to pray? Well, I think, you kind of pray without ceasing. You pray as you need to. But there's a few times in the Bible, in Psalms, it talks about praying morning, noon, and night. And that's probably what Daniel did. But three times a day, he gets down on his knees. There's so much as, why do we kneel when we pray? Well, here's a good example of it. Daniel kneeled when he prayed, so why shouldn't we? And anyway, so he prayed as he continued as he did. Verse 11, then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. Well, of course they did. They knew the trap was set. They knew Daniel wouldn't quit serving his God. So all that was a matter was just going and catching him. So verse 12, then they came near and spake before the king concerning the king's decree. And here we go. Hast thou not signed a decree that every man that shall ask a petition of any god or man within 30 days, save of thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? And the king answered and said, the thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. So, first thing to say, hey, king, by the way, do you remember here a while back you signed a little law about only praying and asking you for things? The king's like, well, yeah, of course. Yeah, we just did it. The ink hadn't even dried, we just did that, and, you know, according to law, Medes and Persians, it's law. We wrote it down, of course. You know, it's fixed. We can't change it. So verse 13, the trap is sprung. Then answered they and said before the king that Daniel, which is of the, which is of the children of the captivity of Judah, regardeth not thee, O king, nor the decree that thou hast signed, but maketh his petition three times a day. So now the trap is set, and they say, that Daniel who's one of those Jews, he doesn't listen to you. He's not obeying the law, king. Now, what are you going to do about it? You know, according to that law, you better throw him in the, you know, in the den of lions, because that's what you said. So, verse 14, then the king, when he heard these words, was sore displeased with himself and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. So the king immediately, I just see the color drain from his face. He realizes he's been duped. He's been tricked. And he gets his best legal minds. He looks for any loophole he can to stop what he has to do according to the dictates of the law. And he can't find it. Now, I'll point out here, this is something my pastor pointed out to me after I taught this lesson. I've kind of emphasized it a little bit. I always thought it was very interesting as you read this. In verse 3, it says, this Daniel. In chapter 5, it says, this Daniel. It just keeps saying, this Daniel. Well, all of a sudden, in verse 13, they say, that Daniel. You can tell the accusation there. You know, really, you have this Daniel who's out there just trying to do what God wants him to do. And then they say, well, there's that Daniel, you know, pointing their finger at him. And it's like, okay, which one are we going to be? Are we going to be this Daniel or that Daniel? Are we going to be the one that they're constantly accusing, and, you know, maybe the accusation's right? Or are we going to be this Daniel who's just being faithful and doing his job and serving God? You know, good little sermon thought, I thought, that he had. Verse 15, then these men assembled unto the king and said unto the king, know, O king, that the law of the Medes and the Persians is that no decree nor statute with the king establisheth may be changed. So it's like, king, it's, 24 hours later and Daniel still is not lion chow. You do remember, you have to do it. You know, we can't get by. It's a law. You have to follow the law. So verse 16, then the king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. Now the king spake and said, Daniel, thy God whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee. Let's go and read verse 17. A stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel. Now, briefly, let me talk about the history of feeding people to the lions. There is very little history about feeding people to lions. But the Latin term is damnatio ad bestias, which basically means judgment by beast, something like damnation by beast, something along death by beast. Basically, you know, instead of us chopping off your head or firing squad or, you know, any other form of execution, this one is, hey, we're going to feed you to the wild animals. We're going to let the wild animals kill you. And there's, you know, a bunch of different forms. It could be lions, tigers, bears, oh my, or I guess snakes, whatever the case may be. So, as far as history is concerned, it appears from some stuff I looked up that as early as about the 6th century BC, that there are records of execution by, you know, feeding people to animals. It's a little bit hard to tell. There could be some before then, but that's kind of the earliest sure record that we have, which will still fit with the time frame of Daniel. We know that the practice was outlawed in Rome in 681 AD. So up till 681 AD, you could still be, you know, fed to the lions. As far as how this worked, the den that's mentioned here is probably like a pit or a cave. one description that I saw said it may have been somebody found like an old one, not in this area. It's one that dated back just like 500 or 600 years, but it said it had like two rooms and they had openings in the top where you could throw food down there. And then you could like, close doors in between and kind of get down and clean out the different areas and stuff. A modern zoo kind of works very similar to that. But anyway, this is probably a pit or a cave, and there's an opening at least at the top of it that they have some type of door on, you know, that so the lions don't climb out. And and through that hole, that's where they would throw their food or, you know, victims down to the lions. So that's kind of how this would work, is it some type of cave or pit, something along those lines. The small opening at the top, and they would just open that and just throw them down in there. And maybe, honestly, to me, Daniel being in his 80s, surviving that fall may be as big a miracle as not being eaten by the lions. So, but not only is he thrown in there, they put a stone and they seal it. Give you an idea, does that remind you of something? Maybe, you know, when they buried Christ, they put the stone and sealed it. Anyway, so the king seals it with his own seal. So basically, by the authority of the king, do not open this. And I like it in verse 16 that the last words the king speaks to his trusted friend, Daniel, is, you know, basically hopelessness. What he's not saying hope, saying, you know, Daniel, don't worry, buddy, your God's going to save you. Basically, I think the king looks at him and just sorrowfully says, Daniel, your only chance is something supernatural, bud. And you better hope that God you serve saves you, because there's no other hope for you. So they sealed in there. He's been thrown down into the den full of lions. Verse 18. Then the king went to his palace and passed the night fasting. So, I'll keep reading. Neither were instruments of music brought before him, and his sleep went from him. So the king goes back to his palace. He can't sleep. He's so tore up about what's happened. I imagine he's mad at those rulers who tricked him. He's so upset about what he thinks is the loss of his friend and most trusted ruler under him and Daniel. He can't sleep. He doesn't eat. You know, he skips supper. He skips his midnight snack. He's too upset to even eat. Normally, a king or somebody who have trouble sleeping, they, might bring in musicians to help play and calm him down and get him to sleep. Well, not even that. No entertainment, nothing. I just imagined him pacing up and down his bedroom, or maybe he's like in a library and he's thinking maybe there is some law, and he's still holding out some hope that maybe he can find something. But I just imagine him pacing the floor and just think to himself, what have I done? What have I been tricked to? They've killed Daniel because I was foolish. I can just imagine what's going on in his mind. So verse 19, then the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste into the den of lions. So I just imagine first glimpse of daylight, king's got his clothes on. He's going out the door. He's going there. He stood it as long as he could. Verse 20, and when he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel. And the king spake and said to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God whom thou servest continually able to deliver thee from the lions? Now, when he says that, I don't think he's expecting an answer. When it talks about lamentable, I can't even say it. That's like crying. That's like, imagine someone over the grave of a loved one, crying out and speaking to them. And that's kind of the picture I have with this king. That's basically what he thinks he's doing. He's going to Daniel's grave, and he's just pouring out his heart and saying, oh, Daniel, is there any way you can come back? Basically, I don't think there's any hope in his mind with what he's saying there. Verse 21, then said Daniel unto the king, O king, live forever. So then right there, the king drops dead of a heart attack because the person he thought was dead speaks back to him. But, you know, from down in the den, here comes Dale saying, "Oh, king, live forever." Verse 22, "My God hath sent his angel and hath shut the lion's mouths that they have not hurt me, for as much as before him innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt." So Daniel calls up to report, "King, don't worry about it. Remember what you said about, you know, God, that God I serve taking care of me? Well, guess what he did? And a miracle's happened. He sent an angel, and the angel told all the lions to keep their mouth shut and lay down and be still, and I'm here. I'm still alive. Nothing short of a miracle." Verse 23. "Then was the king exceeding glad for him." Of course he is. You know, he gave up Daniel for dead. And, you know, I think he's been beating himself up, thinking he killed his trusted advisor. It says, "And commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den." So I guess they let down a rope or something and pulled him back up. I don't think people would be going down in there if they had a choice. "So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found upon him, because he believed in his God." So they get Daniel up and they look, and there's not a claw mark. There's not a bruise. There's not a scratch. You know, his clothes are all still in order. If there's a lion hair on him, it may be because he, you know, used a lion for a pillow that night and took a nap. But Daniel comes up completely unscathed. Sound familiar? Yeah, it sounds just like what happened to the three Hebrew boys in the fiery furnace, doesn't it? You know, they came out, didn't even smell like smoke. Verse 24. "And the king commanded, and they brought those men which had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives, and the lions had the mastery of them, and break all their bones in pieces, or ever they came at the bottom of the den." So if you think, well, the lions weren't hungry. Well, they had a feast. Everybody who was involved in the plot that tricked the king executes. Which, I mean, hey, they just betrayed him. They just tricked him. He can't trust those jokers anymore. So, a little ancient, hardcore justice there. But takes them and their families. Sometimes, some crimes in some areas of the world, even under the Jewish law. Think about what happened to, in the book of Joshua. I've gone blank on his name. The guy that took the... took the clothes and stuff from the Battle of Jericho. What's his name? I've lost it. I got to look it up because it's going to drive me crazy. I know that. We're going to flip back here and find it. Achan! I could not believe I forgot Achan. Anyway, but, old Achan, you know, they executed his whole family also. So, not completely unheard of in the ancient world to, have the crimes of one person family taken out on the whole family. Talk about the lions had mastery of them, so they didn't even stand a chance. They couldn't put up a fight. The lions just tore them to shreds. Said, you know, their bones were in pieces before they even hit the bottom of the den. The lions were tearing them to shreds before they could even hit the ground when they were thrown in. Verse 25. "Then King Darius wrote unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth." So he sends out a decree. "Peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree," verse 26, "that in every dominion of my kingdom, men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and steadfast forever, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end." We'll go and read verse 27. "He delivereth and rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, and hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lions." Let's look a little bit at this decree. You know, Darius makes this decree, sends it out to all people, nations, and languages. Terminology I believe we've already seen used in the book of Daniel. So basically sends it to everybody. This isn't just, for the leaders. This isn't just, an upper level thing just for the rulers and the top level people or government officials. He sends this out, wants it posted on, every telephone post, read it in the town square, put it up in the bank in the post office. He wants everybody to see this thing. And when you look at it, he basically tells everyone, says, hey, you better pay attention and respect the God of Daniel, the Hebrew God. And he describes him that he's a living God, that he's alive, he's active, that steadfast forever, you know, that he's unmovable, that he's strong, that he's powerful, that his kingdom shall not be destroyed, that basically no one is going to overthrow him, that he's going to do what he wants to do in the affairs of men. And his dominion shall be even unto the end, that basically forevermore, for all eternity, God will reign, God will be in control. So, I mean, boy, there's a lot of good stuff there he's saying about God. Now, remember, he's still a pagan. I don't know that he, you know, converted at this point. There's nothing in there that really would say that or hint at it. But basically, in a polytheistic society, he's pointing out to people and saying, hey, I know these Jews don't play along with us. They've got their one God, and we've got all our dozens of them over here. But you had better pay attention to that one God they have and don't look down on them, because that one God they have is a powerful God. So I think that's more along the lines of what he's saying, kind of like we talked about with like Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 27 talks about delivereth and rescueth and worketh signs and wonders. That's talking about the power and the activeness of God. And points out at the very end, you know, that he delivered Daniel from the power of the lion. So I think he's wanting to make an example. And this part, maybe part of this decree also, if there's a political motive, is basically just saying, hey, everybody, you know, people tried to mess with me. They tried to mess with Daniel. It wasn't a good idea. You know, God delivered Daniel. So before you, you better think twice before you come after me or come after Daniel. Verse 28, so this Daniel, once again, this Daniel, not that Daniel, this Daniel, prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So the epilogue to the life of Daniel given here in the middle of the book, you know, but at the end of the historical portion here, is that Daniel continued and lived through the reign of Darius, even unto where Cyrus takes over control of, you know, the region, the territory of Babylon. And I can imagine, you know, what did he do? He's already 80-something years old. I think he did exactly what he was doing before. He's still a trusted advisor, an active administrator, as long as he's physically able. But the main thing that he did, he was steadfast and unmovable in his faith, in practicing that faith. And I don't think that is unreasonable to assume at all that prospered. Yeah, he still had power, still had authority, but he prospered spiritually also. And we'll see that as we look at some of the prophecies in the second half of the book that kind of take place during that time or very late in his life. So anyway, that wraps up chapter 6 of the book of Daniel. I appreciate you listening. Next time, we'll jump into chapter 7. And if you thought I spent a long time, over an hour, going through the book of Daniel, the next one is probably going to be long. I'm going to warn you. But anyway, we'll get into that next time, into chapter 7. I appreciate you listening. Check out BaptistBasics.org for other resources. And email me, podcast@BaptistBasics.org. Anyway, I appreciate you listening. I hope it's been a helping and blessing to you. I'm Matthew Gage, and I will see you next time.